Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Good Sunday evening. Let's see, make sure we're on the air here. Yes, we are. It's not a show with me at the board unless there's some sort of glitch at the front. Are you there, Mike? Mike? Oops.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. The slider was all okay. Down. See, I had to do something. Welcome to the Interpreter Radio Show, sponsored by the Interpreter Foundation, which is a nonprofit educational organization focused on the scriptures of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, early LDS history, and related subjects. I'm here in the studio with Chris Fredrickson. Mike Parker is dialed in from southern Utah. This first hour, we're going to deal with the Come Follow Me lesson that covers Helaman chapters 1 through 6. Let me also mention that the radio show is sponsored by Cruise Lady, the best in LDS tours at cruiselady.com. Okay. Helaman, the book of Helaman, let me give a brief introduction here, represents a shift of gears on the part of Mormon, our editor. He spent 63 chapters covering 40 years, having to do with missionary work and wars. We're going to cover 20 years in the first six chapters here. And it's the focus is less, and then Mike made this observation while we were preparing for the show tonight, that the focus, by and large, is less doctrinal and more political mostly political and geopolitical. We're going to see some big shifts back and forth, some big changes here as we go on. And I think this is very deliberate. Now, notice that something to consider is that in the Book of Alma, Alma actually dies before the book ends, and the latter portion of the Book of Alma is the record according to Helaman, the son of Alma. The Book of Helaman is the book of Helaman, the son of Helaman, the son of Alma, the son of Alma. And so I think this was a deliberate editorial shift to break up the two books that way rather than have both Helamans in the Book of Helaman. He had the older Helaman at the end of the Book of Alma, and he's got the younger Helaman here. And I think it is because of this political structure, and we sort of, things get exciting right off the bat. Mike, do you want to talk about what we have going on in Helaman 1?
Oh, what's interesting to me is, just to begin, is Mormon's heading, where he begins an account of the Nephites, and then his second statement is their wars and contentions and their dissensions. And boy, does that really describe the Book of Helaman. I mean, it's like, thanks for the heads up there. You were right. We were discussing this off the air before we started tonight, and my comment was that the Book of Helaman is really a cautionary tale, and that's going to run all the way up through 3 Nephi chapter 7. It just shows all the mistakes and dumb decisions that the Nephites made, to the point where the Lamanites and the Nephites even switched places in the middle of the book, where the Lamanites become more righteous than the Nephites are. And this is a huge warning that's leading all the way up to the destructions in 3 Nephi chapter 8. But it begins right off the bat with a story of an attempt to overthrow the Nephite government, where Pahoran died. He had been the chief judge, and he's got three sons, and they sought to fill the judgment seat. And Pahoran the second was chosen by the voice of the people. His brother, whose name I have a very hard time pronouncing, I'm going to just try something like Pa'anki.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, he's only in there for a few verses, and so I don't have to worry about pronouncing it for very long. He incited a rebellion, but he was arrested, tried, and then executed for sedition. And a supporter of Pa'anki, whose name is Kishkumen, he goes and he murders Pahoran, Pa'anki's brother, Pahoran the second, who is on the judgment seat. And so now you've got Pahoran, the father, is dead, and two of his older sons are dead. And then Pahoran's only remaining brother, Pakumeni, or I don't know how to, something like that, he becomes chief judge. But what's really interesting about this, and I'm looking forward to talking about this, is that Keshkumen, the murderer of Bahorn II, he and his group, his band, formed a secret society that was bent on overthrowing the Nephite government. And this is the beginning of the Gadianton Band. And we're going to see this develop when we get to Chapter 2.
Chris, thoughts?
Yeah, and we're going to see that Gadianton Band off and on right until the end of this civilization. As he says, you know, later on in these chapters, they're going to prove the entire downfall of the Nephite civilization. I think the other interesting point, as you've mentioned, is that this is not about good Nephites and bad Lamanites, but what we see here is we're even going to see Samuel the Lamanite getting on the wall a little later, not our chapters, but where it's going to be the Lamanites that are going to be proselytizing the Nephites because of their great wickedness. We see that pride cycle kicking in at this period of time. Consistently, it's amazing, and it certainly is a warning to us. You know, if I was going to say anything about this these chapters, I would say that they are so prescient and pertinent to the world that we live in today. There's a reason Mormon chose them. He was very careful. He had an enormous amount of records to choose from here, probably a vast archive, you know, of source material to draw upon. And he's going to talk about the evils of pride if you were going to distill down what his message is. And we are going to see how these people reform, retrench, they are blessed, they become wealthy, and then they devolve into wickedness again. And it's a constant ongoing cycle, but eventually it's going to catch up with them. It kind of reminds me, I was in Florida last week, and, you know, if you get in the ocean, swim beyond the breakers, you can have a pretty gentle swim. And so I was doing that down there, but there was an undercurrent. And when that undercurrent got a hold of me, I couldn't swim against it and get back to my place that I had left from. It wasn't problematic. It's a long stretch of beach. It was in Naples, Florida. It was beautiful. It was a little, you know, windy day, but it was extremely difficult for me to get out. And I finally basically just exited the water and walked a little bit up the beach. But when you get caught up in this cycle, and particularly when you devolve into wickedness, we can't take for granted how difficult it is sometimes to extricate ourselves. Doesn't mean we can't, but it's extremely difficult to do, and we need to be very careful. And so this is certainly a morality tale here, but this is also a cautionary tale to all of us today. And that's where I find these chapters so compelling, is because I would suggest that they certainly do speak about practices that are alive and well and in the world that we live in today. And, you know, I will say one other thing here that I think is really quite fascinating. Let me grab this. I wasn't going to do this early, but I'm rereading Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis, and he says something that I thought was so fascinating. It helps us understand what's going on in these chapters and perhaps what's going on in our world today. But he talks about when we talk about Christianity, Christianity agrees, he's talking about dualism, he says Christianity agrees that this universe is at war. But Christianity does not think that it is a war between independent powers. Christianity thinks that this is a civil war, a rebellion, and that we are living in a part of the universe occupied by the rebel. Enemy-occupied territory, that is what this world is. Christianity is the story of how the rightful king has landed and is calling us all to take part in a great campaign. Then he says, when you go to church, you are really listening in to the secret wireless from our friends. That is why the enemy is anxious to prevent us from going to church. But I think what's really, I mean, both of those points are very powerful, but particularly powerful is the notion or idea. And, you know, I also just finished two books on women in the OSS during World War II, and they were in occupied France. And they had to be constantly vigilant beyond anything you can possibly imagine, because the slightest slip would cost them their lives. And it did cost many of them their lives. But when we realize, you know, that this is, you know, a plan that Satan has enormous power and has enormous control over what goes on in the affairs of men, it kind of helps us understand how vigilant we need to be when we think of the fact that we're living in enemy-occupied territory, and this is certainly the case for these people we're going to talk about in these six chapters.
To get back to a point that was made earlier, most of the wars in these chapters are civil wars. They're Nephites against Nephites. It's Nephite dissenters who, in some cases, and if you read carefully, Mormon doesn't give a lot of detail, but he talks about actual conflict within the Nephite society itself. And then the losers tend to go up to the Lamanites and try to drum up the Lamanites, get them to attack. And the pattern we saw back in Alma is repeated here, where the Lamanites are like, no, no, we're fine. We're for this. And the we have right off the bat in Helaman 1, we have Coriantumr, who's a descendant of Zarahemla. So we have this long simmering dispute between the Mulekites who were there and the Nephites who came in under King Mosiah the First. And you've got Tubaloth, who's the son of Amram, and Amram himself is a Nephite dissenter. So these are basically Nephites who are weaponizing the Lamanites, trying to reconquer and establish power and authority over the Nephite society. And of course, Nephite society is cooperating by having all these dissensions and problems and losing their divine protection in the process. Now, one of the things I like about this particular invasion by Coriantumr, I'm a student of military history. I started playing war games when I was in high school. And this is such a classic, classic maneuver. And it's nothing that Joseph Smith would know. But this is the thing where you decide to strike at the heartland of your opponent, and they're not ready for it, and you drive yourself in, and then you find that you've plunged yourself into the middle of the heartland, and you've managed to surround yourself. This is almost a textbook case of a common military faux pas, when it ends up costing Coriantumr his life and killing a lot of the Lamanites, but it also kills a lot of the Nephites in the process. So they invade, and they go, rather than, you know, going around on the outskirts or trying to nibble away, they just plunge right straight to Zarahemla. It's not being protected. They get in there. They conquer it. They kill the sitting chief judge. And then they think, oh, this is great. We're going to head for Bountiful, and we're just going to roll everything up. And Moroni has been protecting on the outskirts because that's what he anticipates. And so he starts mobilizing all his forces and pulling them in. And Coriantumr realizes, I overextended myself. So you've got supply lines and everything else he's dealing. So he's heading back to Zarahemla, and he's surrounded. He's plunged himself into the middle, he's basically outflanked on either side on a broad level, not just a single battlefield, but he's got Nephite forces in every direction, and he's in this river valley, and there's not much he can do, and they end up losing. Mm-hmm. So that's got some real. I mean, it is so true to life, and I can go through military history and show you battle after battle where this has been a technique on the battle.
Yes, they obviously weren't conversant with Napoleon's invasion of Russia,
yeah.
nor in World War II, the yeah. Nazi invasion of yeah. Russia.
Yeah. Anyway.
Or the Allied invasion of Holland, for that matter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is in A Bridge Too Far, documented, yeah. that film documented that. When you just plunge in and then you give not thought, but not enough thought for supply lines and be able to protect your flanks and have some real plan. You can't just plunge in. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm going to read something Nibley said about it because it's so perfect. Nibley said, Coriantumr's drive had been successful because it was completely unexpected. And it had been unexpected because it was utterly foolish.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Mike, chapter 2. Thoughts on chapter 2?
Well, this is where we get to the origins of the Gadianton Band, which Chris mentioned a little bit ago. This is going to plague the Nephites and Lamanites until the end of Nephite civilization. And this is not the beginnings of the concepts that the Gadianton Band were formed on. We've already talked about in the Book of Mormon, there's a handful of passages that talk about secret combinations, 2 Nephi 9, 2 Nephi 26, and Alma 37 all mention secret combinations, and Alma 37 specifically talks about how secret combinations were the end of the Jaredite civilization. So we know that this has happened, even though we haven't read about it yet, and we won't until we get to the Book of Ether. But we see here Kishkumen is killed, and so Gadianton becomes the leader of Kishkumen's band, and he promises to appoint Kishkumen's followers to positions of power if they will make him chief judge. And it says in chapter 2, verse 8, it was their secret plan and their combination to murder and to rob and to gain power. Ooh, let's talk more about this after the break.
We will talk about this after the break. This is the Interpreter Radio Show. We'll see you on the other side. Welcome back to the Interpreter Radio Show, sponsored by Cruise Lady Latter-day Saint Adventures. Explore the world with a Cruise Lady scholar. We want all the listeners to know the Interpreter Foundation's Book of Moses conference has been moved to September 18th and 19th, and I'd stay tuned to see whether or not that date holds. The Interpreter Radio Show itself is sponsored by Cruise Lady. Join supporters of the Interpreter Foundation on the Ultimate Egypt Tour with Egyptologist John Gee and Professor Daniel Peterson on November 20th of this year. See the best of Egypt, the pyramids of Giza, the Temple of Luxor and Kamak, Valley of the Kings, the magnificent Temple of Ramses II at Abu Simbel. Space is limited, so call Cruise Lady at 801-453-9444 or find more information at cruiselady.com. That's 801-453-9444 or on the web at cruiselady.com. Okay, we're talking about the introduction of Gadianton to the whole secret combination. And I'm sneaking off, and of course, Mormon saying, by the time I'm done here, you're going to see that they were the reason for the destruction of the Nephite people. But we're going to switch back now. In Helaman 3... It's just kind of like, oh, there was no contention for years. You got to wonder what's going on with these Nephites, because they have these brief spurts of 3 or 4 or 5 years when things are fine, and then things aren't fine, and then things sort of fall apart. But we have going here, one of the interesting things about the Book of Mormon, and you may not notice it unless you've read it several times, there is this whole culture centered to the north. You had the migration to the north that was starting and at the end of the Book of Alma, and you've got more migration here. It's obvious that there's quite a number of cities, quite a number of people up there, but they're never discussed. Most they're discussed in passing. You know, people went up there. We get the names of a few cities at the very end when Mormon is talking about the final battles. But aside from that... It's this land northward that we don't hear as much. The place that keeps getting fought over is basically the Zarahemla Bountiful Complex. And this lies between land of Nephi to the south and the land northward, land of desolation to the north. And it's where we're going to see this back and forth that's happening. Chris, some of your thoughts on... Nephi 3 and what's happening with the, or Helaman 3 and what's happening with the Nephites here.
It's interesting, you know, people are leaving. And obviously, they're displeased with what's going on in the country. We see, of course, the rise in chapter 2 of Kishkumen and his Gadianton. He becomes the leader of this band. It's like, you know, Adolf Hitler steps in, takes over control of the NSDAP, and then it becomes the Nazi Party. Lenin comes in. There's the Bolsheviks, the Mensheviks. He takes control of the Bolshevik Party, and then, of course, he leads that revolution in Russia. These people are very gifted. They're very talented. They're very skilled at what they do. It describes Gadianton, exceedingly expert in many words. So he's smooth. He's cunning. He's crafty. They've taken a religious oath, actually, that they're going to, you know, keep their secrets amongst themselves. And then it says he's, in his craft, he's expert in carrying on the secret work of murder and robbery. So as I mentioned, he's a sociopath. And I can imagine that many people are disgruntled with everything that they see going on in this society, and they want out. And so their, you know, recourse is to head up and hopefully get away. They're going to find themselves, you know, embroiled in contentions and problems themselves later on. Nevertheless, they want to get out. But we also see in this chapter, you know, many wars, and dissensions among the people. And it's always fascinating to consider, you know, as Mormon interjects frequently here, it says, you know, 1/100th part of the proceedings of this people cannot be contained in this work. And so he's just picking and choosing. And I would suggest that as you read these chapters, you read them, that he makes it very clear when he's writing the Book of Mormon that I'm writing this book with the people living in our day, I'm talking about our day now, in mind. And so he's going to present us with chapters and with, he's going to present us with material that is very relevant and pertinent for us so that we can negotiate the world that we live in today. And what do we see? We see Helaman, he has his two sons, Nephi and Lehi. They are going to be righteous young men, which of course indicates to us the real possibility that we can maintain righteousness in the world that we live in today, where certainly a lot of things seem to be going south, particularly here in American society, but around the world in consequence of, you know, all the uprisings and all the mobocracy that we're seeing in the world today. And we also see the persecution of righteous individuals. But we see some extraordinary promises of a merciful Father in heaven. In chapter 3, verses 27 through about 30, the Lord is merciful unto all who will, in the sincerity of their hearts, call upon his holy name. And he's talking to the righteous as well as to the wicked. And so he says, please come, reform, and come back to the gospel of Jesus Christ. And then he says, whosoever will may lay hold upon the word of God, which is quick and powerful, which shall divide asunder all the cunning and snares and wiles of the devil, and lead the man of Christ in a straight and narrow course across that everlasting gulf of misery, which is prepared to engulf the wicked and land their souls in, with God in the kingdom of heaven. It's the promise that as we stay attuned to the principles of the gospel, as we study the gospel of Jesus Christ, as we listen to prophets and apostles, we too can be guided through the tumultuous times that we are living in today. And then, of course, we see pride entering into the church and the hideous consequences of pride, particularly their complete disregard for the needs of those that are poor and suffering, as well as the persecution. And I think, and you know, I see this a lot today, and I don't know if it's even intentional, but sort of the mockery of faithful members of the church. And they have to deal with all of these things, but those that choose righteousness because of their humility, because of their faith in Jesus Christ, they're able to negotiate these very treacherous times.
Mike, your thoughts?
Well, I'd like to focus for a few minutes on this concept of secret combinations, because we've heard about them, and now we're starting to see them in action, and they're discussed quite a bit in these chapters, 2 and 3 and through here. The term combination is a little bit tricky because we don't it's defined in a way that we don't use it anymore. It's an archaic definition. It was still present during Joseph Smith's time, and it kind of died out about during Joseph Smith's time. So we don't use that word in the way that the Book of Mormon does anymore. Noah Webster's 1828 English Dictionary, American English Dictionary, is very helpful on this. It defines a combination as an intimate union or association of two or more persons or things by set purpose or agreement for effecting some object by joint operation, in a good sense when the object is laudable, in an ill sense when it is illegal or iniquitous. It is sometimes equivalent to league or to conspiracy. We say, and they give us an example, a combination of men to overthrow government or a combination to resist oppression. So we could call secret combinations, another way to put it would be to say a conspiracy. And that's exactly what's going on here is looking beyond our reading for tonight into chapter 7, it talks about the purpose of secret combinations is to get gain, to be praised of men, to get gold and silver. And in order to do those things, people who engage in the murder and plunder and steal and bear false witness and do all manner of iniquity. Now President Russell M. Ballard, this was Elder Ballard back in 1997 in General Conference, he identified today secret combinations as gangs, drug cartels, and organized crime families. But he pointed out in his General Conference talk that we need to be careful because we see this in the Book of Mormon, is that secret combinations, he says, began among the more wicked part of society, but eventually seduced the more part of the righteous until the whole society was polluted. Mm-hmm. These things are very, very easy to fall into. It's very easy to conspire, to lie or cheat, to increase our own material standing or profit. And then one other thing that I wanted to say about this is that, and I think, Bruce, you alluded to this before the either before or right after the break, that secret combinations, that they're Satan's false counterfeits of sacred covenants. We go to the temple, and in the temple we make covenants to lead lives of holiness and righteousness, and those covenants are sacred, which means that we don't discuss them openly with the world. Secret combinations are covenants to lead lives of wickedness or material gain, and those who enter them, they keep them secret, not out of respect for the covenant, but out of fear of retaliation. They're afraid of being found out. And this is what will eventually bring down Nephite society. We're going to see it as in this run-up to the destructions of Christ's death, and then, of course, when we get to the Book of Mormon, within the Book of Mormon, it simply destroys the Nephites from the inside out, and we need to be very careful that we don't get involved in these things. And they're not just political. They can be business. They can be family. They can be personal. They can be neighborhoods. They can be, mm-hmm. you know, whatever.
Let me point out a couple things that in these chapters, too, that we're talking about right now. Helaman 3, this is a point that's made a couple times in the Book of Mormon. Mormon says, starting verse 15, now there are many records kept of the proceedings of this people, by many of this people, which are particular and very large concerning them, but a hundredth part of the proceedings of this people cannot be contained in this work. Some criticism of the Book of Mormon is, well, why don't we hear more about this, or why don't we have enough details? The Book of Mormon was not written as a history text. It was written as a didactic and polemic text. It is intended to teach. It is intended to present a point of view, which is why one of Mormon's favorite phrases is, and thus we see. So we'll go through three or four chapters of history, and then Mormon will say, and thus we see. And usually it's a negative lesson. But the point, and it gets to both what you, Chris, and you, Mike, have been saying. The Book of Mormon was written to warn us. It's written to tell us what happens. You know, as Hugh Nibley said, woe unto the generation that understands the Book of Mormon. When you read the Book of Mormon, say, my gosh, this looks like modern events. We know how the Book of Mormon ends, and it's not pretty. We know what happens in those circumstances, and these are the things we need to do. But, and Mike, you alluded to this a minute ago, the other message of the Book of Mormon is, while even as society tends downward, individual and even group righteousness can improve. So in the same chapter 3, talking about the persecution of the church, it says in verse 35, nevertheless, they, the members of the church, did fast and pray off and wax stronger and stronger in their humility and firmer in the faith of Christ, even unto the filling their souls with joy and consolation, yea, even to the purifying and the sanctification of their hearts, which sanctification cometh because of their yielding their hearts unto God. So those are the stakes. It's how do we maintain our personal righteousness? How do we maintain Christ-like behavior in spite of the culture? And we get right back into it in Helaman 4 because we have another civil war in the Nephites. And then the losing side runs up to the Lamanites and gets the Lamanites to come down. And this time, the Nephite civilization itself is wicked enough that they've lost their protection. They lose Zarahemla. Mm-hmm. They get pushed all the way back to Bountiful. And they realize that they are weak and that they no longer have the protection of the Lord. Chris.
Well, I was going to add, that was a wonderful synopsis by both Mike and Bruce of that chapter. But also one of the other components that we see coming out in verse 4 is it's not only that there are inroads made by these secret combinations, which are, you know, if we would hold this book to be true, probably all around us, and it's so easy to get sucked into those. one little compromise followed by another, and you're in and over your head. But the other thing that we see here is that when all is said and done, it starts the chapter off where the Lamanites are afraid to go to battle against, but once they build up their forces, once dissenters join them, then they go to battle against. And Mormon here is going to interject his observation that the reason for their great loss, and they're going to suffer great losses from here on for some period of time, is because that it would not have happened had it not been for their wickedness and their abomination, which was among them, that was among those who professed to belong to the Church of God. So when, you know, it's the enemy within is a terrible, terrible enemy, and it was because of the pride of their hearts, their exceeding oppression, their exceeding riches, the oppression of the poor, withholding their food from the hungry and clothing from the naked, smiting their humble brethren, making a mock of that which was sacred. Then it goes on, murder, plunder, lying, stealing, adultery, great contentions. This is what weakens them. Because what we see in the Book of Mormon is we see a people, when we're talking about the Nephites, that are generally outnumbered by the Lamanites. And the Lamanites have some great military minds. But the advantage that the Nephites have is that the Lord is on their side. And so the second they turn away from the Lord, they lose his protection, and then, unfortunately, their decline is assured. And so we see this in this chapter, and it's heart-wrenching to see that, you know, that they have chosen that path to follow.
Sorry, I was going to say something here.
I'll jump in.
Oh, jump in,
if you want.
Jump in. We've got about a minute before the break.
Yeah.
Jump in and say something.
Yeah. Well, I'm so grateful that Chris read that. I had that same passage in Helaman 4, verses 11 and 12, marked to Sheriff, and she beat me to it. I'm glad she did, because it is so profound in explaining that the problem of the Nephites was not that they lacked adequate military strategy. Moronihah is Moroni's son. He was trained at the feet of his father, and he's a very, very competent military commander, but he cannot retake the other half of Nephi lands that they were just unable to grab because of the wickedness of the people. And why does Mormon include this? Because the same thing happened in his time. He's a righteous general leading an unrighteous people, and they were unable to solve any of their problems or to be military successful, even though he was a great general.
Okay, and we'll see you all after the break. This is the Interpreter Radio Show. Welcome back to the Interpreter Radio Show. This is Bruce Webster with Chris Fredrickson and Mike Parker. Interpreter Radio Show is sponsored by Cruise Lady. Go to cruiselady.com for the best in LDS tours. Okay, Helaman 5 and 6. Now, this is, Mike alluded to this earlier in the show. This is where we see this major reversal of roles. It's been building up here, but we're going to start with Nephi basically resigning. Now, it's unclear if he's actually forced out of office or if he's just disgusted and steps down, or if you have the Nephite equivalent of a vote of no confidence. But it basically says, you know, the government is, the people in power are the wicked people, and Nephi's like, I'm out of here. I'm going to go preach. Basically echoing what Alma did as chief judge, stepping down, except Alma handed it over to someone who is righteous. Nephi's kind of like, yeah, Zoram's taking over, and this isn't going to end well. So we've got... we've got Nephi and Lehi going up, basically doing this grand missionary tour to try and strengthen the church to get new members. Mike, a few observations on your part.
Oh, there's this lovely passage in chapter 5. It runs from verses 5 to 13, where we're kind of carried back in time to when Nephi and Lehi, these brothers, were young, and their father spoke to them. And there's this long quotation of the words that he taught them. And he gives them counsel, and he tells them that he gave them the names Nephi and Lehi so they would remember their forefathers who left Jerusalem and their good works, and so that they would also do that which is good. and he exhorted them to treasure up the gift of eternal life and to remember the teachings of Mosiah and Amulek about salvation and redemption in Christ through repentance. It's just this little nugget of inspiration right there in the middle of chapter 5. And then we get to verse 12, which is one of the most powerful verses in the entire Book of Mormon, and I think certainly the most powerful verse in the Book of Alma, I'm sorry, in the Book of Helaman, where Nephi recalls his father telling him in his youth, "And now remember, my sons, remember that it is upon the rock of our Redeemer, who is Christ, the Son of God, that ye must build your foundation, that when the devil shall send forth his mighty winds, yea, his shafts in the whirlwind, yea, when all his hail and his mighty storm shall beat upon you, it shall have no power over you to drag you down to the gulf of misery and endless woe, because of the rock upon which ye are built, which is a sure foundation, a foundation whereon if men build, they cannot fall." It reminds me quite a bit of the house that I live in, which is we sit on what was once a volcanic plain. There are ash cinder cones all around us. They're no longer active. Of course, they've been dormant for many thousands of years. But our home sits on a foundation of lava rock. In fact, they had to use blasting equipment to grade the property. If you dig down more than about 18 inches through the soil that the builders laid down, you hit volcanic rock, which is really, really hard stuff. And the nice thing about it is that this house isn't going anywhere. You know, and I don't care how much it rains or how much it gets windy, and it does get quite windy here. This house is stable and secure, and it reminds me of this passage, which is one of the reasons why I love it so much, is that if we build our foundation, our spiritual foundation on Christ, who is the rock, our Redeemer, then when all of these bad things happen in our lives, as they happen to everybody, we will not be moved. We will not lose our faith. We will not lose our confidence in Him. We will not become antagonists and oppose the gospel of Christ and turn aside. We will be faithful and steadfast. It's a lovely passage, one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm. Chris.
It's one of my favorites, too. I've got that highlighted because it's just so powerful. It's powerful testimony of Jesus Christ. It's pretty, I won't say it's unparalleled, but it certainly is one of the greatest, I would say, in all of Scripture. In chapter 5, I'm going to go back a little bit to those early verses and what we're seeing in government. You talked a lot about secret combinations. Mike, and I'm going to talk a little bit about what's going on in the government during this period of time. And again, you know, how can we apply this today? It says here the laws had become corrupted. Now, that's quite fascinating to me. Today I was just reading, I got this book by G. Homer Durham. It's Joseph Smith's Political Views, basically. And in there is the Nauvoo Charter. And so I was reading through the Nauvoo Charter, and Joseph Smith always was very careful to articulate that we believe, and in the Doctrine and Covenants he makes this point, particularly makes this point, is that we believe we support the Constitution of the United States. But he also alludes to the fact, but when men make laws of their own that are not in keeping with the Constitution, that this is a very troubling thing. And so throughout the Nauvoo Charter, one of the things that he says is with, you know, that Nauvoo Charter was meant to defend the saints after they had been so severely persecuted. And so they had enormous power that they, you know, and was accepted by the state. And then it was very difficult, of course, but the state took their guns away eventually and, you know, their ability to protect themselves. But they were very careful with that charter to give themselves enormous power. But every time they did craft a law or, you know, a statute in that Nauvoo Charter, it says that it is in as long as it is in keeping with the Constitution of the United States. Well, here are laws that had become corrupted, meaning, you know, these laws that had come with the brass plates. Mosiah, of course, articulates the laws. They are a Christian law, obviously, you know, based on the Ten Commandments. Our laws are based on Judeo-Christian ethics as well in American society today. But then it says in verse 3, this was not all. They were stiff-necked people, insomuch they could not be governed by the law nor by justice. And, you know, my little note there to the side is in democratic societies, we often fail to realize that laws are only as good as people are willing to obey them. And we're seeing this in much of the chaos that we're seeing in American society today. When people determine that they are going to be lawless, it's very difficult sometimes to rein them in, no matter what kind of laws that you have. And I think what happens here is you have Nephi, and he realizes that the real power, when all is said and done, and we particularly see this in verse 12, is in bearing testimony of Jesus Christ. And so he's going to give up the judgment seat to Sazoram. And he says here, you know, they've chosen evil, the laws have become corrupted, I'm wasting my time here in, you know, government, and there are much better things that I and my brother can do. And so they are going to go out and they are going to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. And just a teaser to verse 6, one of the interesting things is that when they go and when they preach to, this is in chapter 6, you know, we have the Lamanites, and they're going to preach to the Nephites. But even when they go to the most hardened Lamanites, and those that are members of the Gadianton robbers, and that's a mixture of both, but it's primarily Nephites at this period of time. But the way that they confront their wickedness, and it says that here in verse, I think it's a 38 through 41, but it says that the Lamanite solution, as they're preaching the gospel to the horrors affected by the Gadianton robbers, was to hunt them and not to kill them, but to preach the word of God to them. And in this way, they were effective in destroying the Gadianton robbers from among the Lamanites. So that's extraordinary when you think about it, that it's by preaching the word of God.
Now, the second half of chapter 5 talks about this missionary, this grand missionary effort by Nephi and Lehi. And first they go to Zarahemla and preach and have great success among the Lamanites there. And then they go up to the land of Nephi. So it's of course fascinating to see this axis between the land of Nephi, Zarahemla, and Bountiful. That's the central axis that pretty much the whole history of the Book of Mormon bounces back and forth. So now they're going all the way up to the land of Nephi, and they get thrown in prison and sentenced to death. And it's too long to summarize here, but basically when they come in to execute them, you have this grand scene here where they're surrounded by light, and the Lamanites are, of course, terrified of what's going on. You have this one who's a Nephite by birth, who had once belonged to the church but dissented, who said they're speaking to the angels of God. And you have this tremendous conversion among Lamanites, which is where we tend to see the tremendous conversion. Have you ever noticed that the church grows among the Nephites, and within about 3 or 4 years, they're all wicked again? Church grows among the Lamanites, and it tends to last a long time. We passed over it, but there was a mention of the people of Alma being among the groups that moved into the land northward. And that's the last of the anti-Nephi Lehis. So here, the Lamanites have this massive conversion, and they say, here, you can have Zarahemla back. we'll withdraw all the way back to our pre-war borders. And you have this great fellowship that suddenly springs up between the two cultures. But the irony is that it's a Lamanite culture that's righteous, and it's a Nephite culture that's wicked. It's a Nephite culture that's continuing to embrace the secret combinations, and it's the Lamanites who are trying to do with the secret combinations. Zoram ends up getting murdered as well, as does his son. And I believe there's a period here where we don't know who's on the judgment seat, because after Sazoram's son is mentioned, I think it's quite a few years before we get mention of it's basically the later chapters when we get into what I referred to during the break as CSI Zarahemla. Two of my favorite chapters. The whole story of Ammonihah. Great political and legal theater. Anyway. It's not until then that we get a name of a chief judge again, and it's only because he's dead and his brother murdered him. So you've got this, as Mike alluded at the very start, this tremendous reversal here, where it's the Lamanites who are righteous, they're trying to preach to the Nephites, they're trying to remove the secret combinations from among them, and it's the Nephites who are embracing the secret combinations wholeheartedly, and thus sowing the seeds of their own destruction. And we get to the end. I mentioned earlier that you know, Mormon loves his and thus we seize. And here at the end of chapter 6, he says, "And thus we see that they, the Nephites, were in an awful state and ripening for an everlasting destruction." Mike, your thoughts on we've got just a couple of minutes here. Your thoughts on this whole section in these chapters.
Well, just your CSI Zarahemla thing was hilarious. I could just see Nephi, you know, making some witty comment while he puts on his sunglasses, kind of, you know.
It's in his convertible.
Yep.
Yeah, right.
Go check the skirts of his blanket. You'll find the blood there.
That's right.
Forensics. Earliest documented forensics. Anyway, go on.
It's absolutely tragic, and I can only imagine how heart-wrenching it was for Mormon to have to include this, because when he's writing this, the same thing is happening to his people. This is very, very present for him. And the reason why, and you can wonder, you know, why so much detail? Why is the Book of Helaman spend so much time on this? And it's because Mormon's living it. He's like, I want to make certain that you understand what brought our people down so that you can avoid it. I mean, they had the chapter 6, they talks about they had secret signs by which that could identify others in their group, and anyone who revealed the secrets would be tried by the laws of the Gadiantans. And it does say in I believe it's around verse 38, the Lamanites were able to eliminate the Gadiantans from their society, but the wicked Nephites, it says, they did build them up and support them. Mm-hmm. And this was until verse 39, these secret societies did obtain the sole management of the government, the Nephite government. It's just tragic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Chris, your thoughts before we got a minute or two before the break here.
Yeah, that ending is so compelling, and it is.
Oh,
I mean,
no, that was the ending.
Chapter 6, tragic, tragic, tragedy.
Okay, that's the end of the first hour here. We will be back after the top of the hour and commercial break. This is the Interpreter Radio Show with Mike Parker, Chris Fredrickson, and Bruce Webster.
Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Welcome to the second hour of the Interpreter Radio Show, sponsored by Cruise Lady. Go to cruiselady.com for the best in LDS cruises. This is Bruce Webster with Chris Fredrickson and Mike Parker. Our show is sponsored by the Interpreter Foundation, which is a nonprofit educational organization focused on the scriptures of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, early LDS history, and related subjects. So this is our second hour. Let's kick off by talking about the latest and greatest on COVID-19, the pandemic, and everything else. Utah Area Presidency came out with a letter asking us to be good citizens and wear masks in public, which I have no problem with. The more interesting thing for me was at church last Sunday, not today. I'm Sunday school president in my ward, and I happened to talk with Michael Riley, who's the bishopric counselor over Sunday school, and we talked for a couple of minutes, and he looked at me and said, "I'm wondering how long it's going to be before we have Sunday school again." At this point, I'm sort of wondering how long it's going to be before we have Sunday school again as well. The church is being cautious, which I think is exactly the right move. It will be very interesting to see what the ultimate consequences are of first a suspension of meetings and then a shift back with short meetings, and whether this ends up having a bit of a winnowing effect. On members who were sort of in the habit of going to church, get out of the habit, and just aren't going to come back. Chris, your thoughts?
I mentioned in some emails that were going back between the three of us that it is going to be interesting how things fall out with all of the COVID. You know, what the church is going to wait for, what markers that they're looking for before things open up. I know that they're still issuing mission calls. My brother and his wife have been called to serve as ambassadors of the church in London, but they've been delayed twice, and now they're sort of on an indefinite hold, but I think maybe the 1st of September. But then a young man in their, in my daughter-in-law's ward got a call to report to the British MTC October 19th. And so I think it's just, you know, they're, you know, it's a wait and see how this disease proceeds. I'm always, you know, wanting to know what the mortality rates are, particularly in comparison with, say, flu. We have a vaccine for the flu. People still get the flu. People go out in the face of those things. And so it's a difficult thing to say how to deal with it. But I'm a temple worker. I'm desperately hoping those temples will open up again. I'm desperately hoping that missionary work opens up again. And I look forward to the day when I can actually go back to church. I'm happy to wear a mask to hide the bags under my eyes. But other than that, we'll see. We'll see what happens. I have no, there's no magic ball on this. And I'm not sure the brethren have a magic ball on it either. You know, we're just caught in this disaster situation. One of the interesting things, I'll compare it to the 1917, you know, flu pandemic that was that killed between 50 and 100 million people worldwide, is that in the, that day and age, there was little you could do in the face of these diseases. And so they just kind of did herd mentality, and an enormous number of people died. That's, I think, is what they're trying to avoid. But also what you see is with that herd herd immunity. But with herd immunity, what you see is that the disease runs its course and then society starts to rebuild itself. But we're in this interesting paradigm where we're trying to evade the disease itself, which, you know, in process of doing that, it seems like it's going to stretch it out a little longer. So I don't know what the future holds, but I do hope things start to open up as they see it appropriate to do so, so that we can get some sense of normalcy back in our lives.
Mike, thoughts and observations?
Well, after, what are we going on now, 4 months, 5 months? I don't know how long. It feels like forever.
whole year feels like forever.
It does. I don't know what to think anymore. If you asked me last April, I would have said, oh, yeah, May, it'll all turn around. And it just keeps going on and on and on and on. And I don't think anybody knows what they're doing or how this is going to end or what the, you know, or what's the end game for this. We're just all kind of sitting around waiting for something. You know, in the meantime, it's more important than ever that we make certain that we're keeping our testimonies strong. My family just the other night read Alma 32. It's a little bit, that's where we are currently in the Come Follow Me. Obviously, what we did last hour, we're running ahead of that. But Alma 32, of course, it talks about faith as a seed. You get to the end of the chapter, and it talks about how if your faith, if you allow it to grow and to sprout, that it becomes a tree springing up into everlasting life. And then you have to nourish the tree, it says. You have to keep digging it and watering it and pruning it and so forth. Otherwise, the tree will wither away, and you'll uproot it and throw it out because you think the tree is bad. How many people has that happened to, even in the best of times, where they didn't nourish their tree of faith, and next thing you know, something difficult came along, and all they had was a withered, you know, husk of a former testimony, and it was very, it's just very easy to uproot it and throw it in the dumpster. How much more difficult is it during a time like this when we can't really socialize with people, which is a big part of our church experience, is meeting together as saints and fellowshipping with one another, and we just kind of sit alone and wait for something, and we don't know where it's ever going to change. So, difficult times.
They are interesting. Now, one thing I've noticed with interest, my wife was called just before this all hit. My wife was called as the advisor to the young women's group, and we have a single. Part of the restructuring that happened with young women's is that they no longer, of course, they got rid of Beehives, My Maids, and Laurels. And you have as many classes as suit your particular ward. And our ward doesn't have a lot of young women, so we have a single young women's class with a presidency. And my wife was called as the advisor, and she and the young women's president have been having activities with the girls over Zoom. And they've actually got this working fairly well. They've done two cooking activities where everyone is on Zoom and some of the girls are cooking stuff and showing what they're doing and so on. And they seem to be having a great... It's interesting because I was sort of like, oh, I wonder if the young women are really going to get into this. And are they going to say, no, but I can hear them because my wife does this in her office and she has her door open. And, you know, they're chatting away in there for like 90 minutes with this extended young women's, you know, going on a weekday, you know, weekday evening. And it sounds like they're just having a grand old time in there. So it will be interesting to see what happens. Now, I've got a family that we were very close to back in Colorado, and we're still in touch. We're all friends on Facebook and so on. And their son, Michael, who, of course, I first knew when he was, like, you know, young primary age, got called on a mission to Mexico last year and went down and was serving, and then got brought home for a while when the pandemic broke out, and then got reassigned to San Diego, Spanish-speaking in San Diego. And he posts regularly on Facebook and via email about his missionary stuff. And they just entered into another lockdown. He says, you know, we're here and we're pretty much stuck in our apartment for at least the next 2 weeks. There's not much we can do. So it's we brought this up, I think, last month or the month before. My almost tongue-in-cheek, but actually semi-serious thing that this is a good dry run for the last days. The church is seeing how things work within the church when you have disruptions in the ability to hold meetings, in the ability to travel, in the ability to gather together. And I suspect there is some deep thought and prayer and pondering going on at the highest levels of the church about what are the long-term implications, even after the pandemic dies out or settles down, what are the long-term implications for what we do in a church and how we do it? I'll be interested to see if there are changes that come out after this. For my own part, I'm an adjunct professor at BYU, and as it currently stands, I teach one class a semester. My class for both fall and winter semester is scheduled as an online class only. So I'm going to be teaching the class via Zoom. It's not a big change for me because all the assignments are done via Learning Suite, which is an online testing and quiz system. And I just need to come up to speed with, you know, multi-user Zoom where I've got, you know, 40 or so students on the other side and figure out how to run that. But, It's interesting changes all the way around. Mm-hmm. Chris?
You know, it reminds me, and I'll butcher this historically, but I remember that Brigham Young was put in charge of one of the evacuations before he was in charge of getting the Saints to Utah. And it mentions that it was a good dry run preparation for him for, you know, leading that evacuation. And so I think that's a really good point that Bruce makes. We've got friends that are in Bosnia on a mission right now. They had the choice to come home or stay. They decided to stay. I think they've been in lockdown now for 5 months. But he was with International Folk Dancers. They taught at BYU. And so he has been teaching all the locked-in missionaries that are still on missions in Europe. He's been teaching them international folk dances. He's been teaching them dances. It's a way to connect, to keep, you know, their spirits up. And I think that's one of the problems here, is keeping people's spirits up. One of the things I cornered my son, he's been in town and he and his wife just left, but I said to him, I'd like to issue a challenge. I said, you know, early on when we were first married and I started having kids, at the end of the day, I'm a reader, I love to read, and I set a kind of a standard for myself before I could open any book that I was totally immersed in at that time, that I would first open and read my scriptures for at least a half an hour, and that I would spend time in the scriptures. But, you know, I see all these young millennials, Generation X, I see a lot of them, and what they're doing is, it's all over Facebook and it's all over social media, excuse me, they're not, so Instagram, but, you know, they're binge-watching all of these different shows, and you can understand why. They're locked in, they're trying to find things to do. But I encouraged him, you know, to follow that pattern before he starts the watching, before he starts the reading to make sure that he's getting that spiritual sustenance that is so desperately needed. And I think, you know, we've got to start finding ways to make sure that we talk about those things, that we encourage those kinds of things, and that we facilitate those kinds of things, maybe even in our wards, but especially among our families.
Mike, further thoughts?
After 5 months, I don't know what else I can say. I am talked out.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Well, and I think part of the problem, there's a term I've seen bandied about, which is safetyism. We have become a very risk-averse society.
Yeah.
And I don't say that, you know, it's sort of the, you know, you're gonna kill your grandmother if you don't wear a mask. Well, no, I'm not gonna kill my grandmother if I don't wear a mask. My grandmother's already dead. I'm in the high risk group. I'm 67. So I'm in you know, one of the highest risk groups and so on. There is a perfect storm here of conflicting information, of the concept that being safe trumps everything else. Sorry, I didn't mean to use the verb trumps there, but being safe is more important than anything else. Mm-hmm. And we've seen, you know, tremendous economic impact from this. We seem to be recovering from that some. I saw that unemployment is down around 5.1% now. Mm-hmm. I think as a society, we have become timid and scared. And when you throw the litigation in there and the possibility of lawsuits and so on, it becomes difficult to figure out, you know, what do I do if, you know, if I own a business, I have an employee of a business, if I'm, you know, running a school, what do I do? What can I do? Mike, I'm sure you're dealing with this. We have kids who have kids of their own, and particularly I've got a daughter and a daughter-in-law who each have 4 school-age kids at home who are sort of absolutely terrified as to what's going to happen this fall. Particularly one of the daughters has been under some significant stress because she's not only had all 4 kids at home since March, but she's had her husband at home for a good part of that time. He was riding his bike to work and hit a deer, ended up breaking ribs, breaking his collarbone, and so on. And so she suddenly found herself home. He was unable to contribute. She had 4 kids, and she was trying to run the whole household. The daughter, she has 4 kids, but she also works full-time at UVU. There are some very serious issues here that families are facing in terms of getting kids back to school. And I see people say, oh, well, just keep them home. Don't you care about your kids? It's like, it's not that simple. This is literally a matter of whether or not you can pay your mortgage or pay your rent.
I think in California, since the COVID outbreak, zero children have died of COVID. Don't quote me on that. I mean, I did hear it on a news show, but nevertheless, 0 children have died from COVID. They don't seem to be the population that is going to be troubled by this. And developmentally for children, that's important too.
Okay, let's take a break here. We'll be back after the commercial.
NLS is a free library.
Welcome back to the Interpreter Radio Show, sponsored by Cruise Lady, the best in LDS tours at cruiselady.com. Okay, let's switch on to another controversial subject. let's talk about John DeLynn. Thank you.
Yeah.
And Jonathan Neville, who are sort of, as Mike and I were discussing offline prior to the show, sort of two sides of the same coin. Mike, I'll let you talk a bit about John DeLynn here, what he's doing.
Oh, this will be fun. So all of this comes about because of an interesting blog post by Stephen Smoot this week.
Yes,
Stephen is an interpreter. Yeah, no, it's really well done. Stephen is a volunteer with the Interpreter Foundation. He's appeared on numerous, well, he's published numerous articles through Interpreter, but also has appeared on Interpreter Radio. I believe he's on monthly. And on his personal blog, he responded to something that famous ex-Mormon critic of the church, John DeLynn, had posted on Facebook this week. And this had to do with a statement that had been made by Richard Bushman about 4 years ago. Richard Bushman is, of course, a very well-known historian of early American history. He's a professor emeritus at Columbia, where he held the Governor Morris chair American history, or I'm probably mangling the end of that, but and of course he's well known among Latter-day Saints for having published a biography of Joseph Smith that came out about 15 years ago. And in a fireside talk that he gave in 2016, he was asked, and I will quote the question and the answer. The question that was posed to him, and this was recorded on video, is, in your view, do you see room within Mormonism for several different narratives, multiple narratives, of a religious experience, or do you think that in order for the church to remain strong, they would have to hold to that dominant narrative? I have to confess I'm not a real fan of the question, because I think it's
leading.
It's question. it is. It's question begging in the way that it's framed. But his response... And, of course, you know, consider that he's speaking extemporaneously here, just off the cuff, trying to respond to what I believe is a rather confusing question to begin with. And so his response was, this is Richard Bushman, quote, I think that for the church to remain strong, it has to reconstruct its narrative. The dominant narrative is not true. It can't be sustained. So the church has to absorb all this new information, or it will be on very shaky grounds, and that is what it is trying to do, and it will be a strain for a lot of people, older people especially, but I think it has to change. Now, clearly, anybody who I think is informed and reasonably honest will understand what Richard Bushman was trying to say there. And he's trying to say that there are parts of Latter-day Saint history and the way that they have been taught and the way that they are commonly understood and believed are simply not accurate. One example of that is that, and this kind of will get to what Jonathan Neville, one of his major issues is about how did Joseph Smith translate the Book of Mormon. Jonathan Neville asserts, and along with other Heartlanders, that it was purely by the use of the Nephite interpreters, or Urim and Thummim, when it's quite clear from eyewitness testimony from many, many people who actually saw the translation process, including Martin Harris, who was a scribe for Joseph and the early translation of the Book of Mormon, that he used, along with that, that he used a seer stone that he placed into a hat. And that's what Richard Bushman was trying to say. Well, for the last 4 years, John DeLynn has been distorting what Richard Bushman has said in multiple social media posts. So here's one from, let's see, what's the date on this one? I want to make certain that I get a quote. This is July 14th, 2020, so this is 5 days ago. And he posted on Facebook, remember that time Richard Bushman admitted that the Mormon Church's historical narrative wasn't sustainable because it wasn't true? Question mark. That was a semi-courageous thing for him to say. And then he goes on to claim that Bushman backtracked on his quote, saying that he was taken out of context. John DeLynn here first is saying that Richard Bushman admitted that the church's historical narrative wasn't true, which Richard Bushman never said, and then calls him semi-courageous for doing this thing. And then he turns around and he backhands him by saying that this is again a direct quote from DeLynn's Facebook posts, unfortunately, being occasionally duplicitous is the tax you pay to remain in good graces with the powers that be, to keep your book in stock at Deseret Book, to get that sweet summer gig teaching at the Maxwell Institute. Yeah, because we all know how much Desert Book pays in royalties.
Yes, I was gonna say this is clearly written by someone who A has never dealt with
published.
Book royalties and B never been an adjunct professor.
Someone who's never published with Deseret. Believe me, if you publish with Deseret Book, it's not because you want to make money.
Yeah.
I can
it's
promise
not.
You that.
Yeah. John DeLynn, he doesn't read books, let alone publish them. So let's be honest here. I'm being a little bit hyperbolic, but not by much. His the amount of reading that he has admitted that he does is very, very limited, which explains a lot of things. So on the one hand, he praises Richard Bushman for claiming that the Mormon Church's historical narrative is false, and then he backhands him for backing out of it because he wants all this sweet Deseret Book revenue and to get this summer teaching gig at the Maxwell Institute, which we know is, you know, that's like six, seven figures or something like that.
Or more.
In pennies.
And so Richard Bushman and so Stephen Smoot, getting to where this is going, you're okay, where is this all this going? Is if you Google Stephen Smoot's blog and take a look at the context here is that after John DeLynn posted this, Stephen Smoot contacted Professor Bushman and asked him, what do you think about this? And Professor Bushman again clarified that no, he does believe that the Book of Mormon is a translation that was inspired by God, that it was conducted the way that Joseph Smith did it, that he still has a testimony, you know, that all of these things that are claimed about him were just false. And John DeLynn just refuses to back down on this. And in fact, I know somebody who, secondhand, this is a friend of a friend, who was unfriended and blocked by John DeLynn on Facebook this week because he questioned whether John DeLynn was being honest about it. It's really sad to see people who have such an agenda against the gospel that they are just where truth becomes secondary. It doesn't matter what you say as long as you're coming down hard on the church and its leaders and its teachings. And I don't think anyone should be dishonest about anything, but especially because we're talking about something as important as eternal salvation and so forth. This is it's foul is what's going on there. So that's the long version of it.
And on the other side, we have Jonathan Neville, who's the probably the most prolific poster on the whole Heartland side of things, and who's just sort of I find his he seems to be digging a hole and he's still digging. He asserts things that are contradicted by extensive church documents, like you said, the that Joseph only ever used the Urim and Thummim. He made a reference to the church's official new history, first official church history since B.H. Roberts, which is the saints. He calls Volume 1 deliberately misleading.
Yeah, and this is a member of the church.
Yeah.
He's a supposed believer who's doing this.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
So it's and he's got two or three hobby horses. One is that, you know, no seer stone was ever used to translate the Book of Mormon in spite of, you know, extensive historical evidence to the contrary. He's also the only person I know of who claims there were actually two sets of plates, not one set of plates. And there's zero historical support for that, but he's absolutely convinced that there were two separate sets of plates that Joseph translated from. He feels the church leaders are being misled by those awful people at Book of Mormon Central and Interpreter Foundation and elsewhere. And if they would just listen to him, then everything would be cleared up. And this is all pretty much to support the Heartland model, which is, as we have discussed from time to time, I have no
problematic.
Trouble. I have no. Well, yeah. The Book of Mormon doesn't support it. If you try and correlate Heartland Book of Mormon geography, makes zero sense, quite frankly. But you know, they're welcome to argue it and so on. But he makes it a matter of apostasy. Basically, those who believe in a Mesoamerican geography are these evil intellectuals who are seeking to mislead the whole church and lead it astray, and the church would be in great shape if only they'd repent and believe the prophets and realize that the Heartland model is the only true model of Book of Mormon geography. And he basically has nothing but negative things to say about the gospel study essays and the various statements the church has come out with. It's kind of like, well, no, I know what's really true. And, you know, there's an old joke, and I mentioned this once in an email to you, Mike. It's because it really applies to both sides. You could cast it either, you know, what's the definition of a Mormon liberal and what's the definition of a Mormon fundamentalist? And in both cases, it's a person who just believes what the prophet would believe if the prophet had all the facts. And you see it's they are mirror images of each other. You see exactly the same attitude, both in the progressive Mormon wing and in the ultra conservative fundamentalist Mormon wing. It's the same thing. We have this information. Both of them tend to make the same argument, saying, well, you know, the brethren really already believe and know this stuff, but the members just aren't ready for it. So you had this whole narrative. In fact, I'm somewhat amused. A few years ago, you had this whole narrative about how there were members of the 12 who really didn't believe the founding truths. And you never said, when was the last time you heard, you know, President Monson bear testimony of the Book of Mormon and Joseph Smith and so on? Of course, that was the testimony he bore in one of his very last talks in General Conference. And the idea was that, you know, the church is trying to prepare people. The reason why they called Ulysses Suarez and Garrett Gong was because they were going to lead the way into this new, more Protestant interpretation of church doctrine and history and scripture. And the irony, of course, is that, if anything, the general conferences of the last few years have been far more focused. I've heard far more references to preparing for the second coming. Very powerful testimonies. And, of course, this last general conference, we had the first presidency statement about the restoration of the church, which pretty much went against all the arguments that these people were making. Likewise, and I'll turn over to Chris here, give us some time before we get to the next break. But likewise, among the fundamentalists, it's like, we know it's really true. I first ran into this actually as an undergrad at BYU, where they said, well, we're following this higher law, and the brethren know about it, but they're just... they don't tell everyone because, you know, most church members aren't ready for it, but we know about this. Chris.
No, I was just going to say that I am just stunned because it's just so unusual to see these kind of detractors. Unless, of course, you've read the Book of Mormon. Unless, of course, you've read the scriptures. Unless, of course, you're familiar with church history. And, you know, I don't want to discount these people. I don't want to malign them. Some of them, I think, are malevolent in their intentions. I know they're malevolent in their intentions. I was in a ward for a long period of time. I happened to be teaching gospel doctrine. There was an individual there. One of the 12 was calling our bishop every week to check on what he was up to. He apparently had stolen some documents from the church history library. He was, you know, an anti-Mormon, and in the classroom he did everything he possibly could to break the spirit, and I finally just kind of cornered him one day, and I said, I'm glad you're in the class, you're welcome to be in the class, but I would prefer you don't say anything if the intention is to, you know, to take the spirit out of the room, to drive the spirit out of the room. You know, one of the great problems in the church and throughout history, I mean, we see this even with, you know, the Trojan horse, is that enemy within. And we need to be so hyper careful about those kinds of individuals who pretend to. I mean, this was the problem we were just talking about in those Helaman chapters. So many of them claimed full fellowship in the church, and yet they began associating with secret combinations to the demise of the faith. And, you know, when you rolled that Trojan horse within the walls of the city, and then the soldiers came out, it was game over for those societies. And so this is something, you know, I can't remember which of the brethren it was. Maybe one of you can mention it. But you'll remember brothers, elder so-and-so said, doubt your doubts before you doubt your faith. And I think that's where we need to remain. It doesn't mean we can't ask questions. We can and we should ask questions. Questions are important. You know, ask questions, probe, search, study, go to your Father in heaven in prayer. Take those questions to them. Build your faith in ways that, you know, will make it concrete so that it is, you know, so that it's anchored in concrete. But when you find individuals who are just straining at gnats, who are nitpicking, who are cherry picking little comments and then distorting them, pulling them out of context, and then, as Bruce mentioned, that are claiming that they know better than the prophet, the brethren, and that they know better than the prophet what God would have us do, it's probably time to leave the room.
And we'll be back after this final break. Welcome back to the last segment of the Tonight's Interpreter Radio Show, sponsored by the Interpreter Foundation, a nonprofit educational organization focused on the scriptures of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, early LDS history, and related subjects. And as you can see here, we go all over the map. The Interpreter Radio Show is sponsored by Cruise Lady, the best in Latter-day Saint adventures. Explore the world with a Latter-day Saint scholar. Join supporters of the Interpreter Foundation on the Ultimate Egypt Tour with Egyptologist John Gee and Professor Daniel Peterson on November 20th of this year. See the best of Egypt, the pyramids of Giza, the temples of Luxor and Kamek, the Valley of the Kings, and the magnificent temples of Ramses II and Abu Simbel. Space is limited, so call Cruise Lady at 801-453-9444 or find more information at cruiselady.com. That's 801-453-9444 or on the web at cruiselady.com. Mike, you said you had some more stuff that you wanted to talk about with the whole Heartland thing.
Well, something else that I thought was a little bit disturbing, and I don't honestly spend a lot of time thinking about this or dealing with their arguments and so forth. I find them just a little bit odd and a bit fanatical. I don't quite understand what the why understanding where the Book of Mormon took place is of such critical importance and so forth. And, yeah. But I did see something kind of vaguely, it was just unsettling. Recently, there is an edition of the Book of Mormon that is published by a Heartland-affiliated press, and it's got marginal notes and so forth that all try to explain how the Book of Mormon took place in the United States and so forth. And there's been a lot of criticism of it, and I think rightly so. I think there's a lot of unfounded claims in there. But on the Amazon.com page for this book, in response to a critical review, someone who claims to be one of the editors of that edition of the Book of Mormon said in his, I assume it's his, it could be her, review that the First Presidency, this is a direct quote, the First Presidency chose to give this book to all new mission presidents for Christmas the world over. And now, I don't know whether or not that's true. I have a couple of friends who brought this to my attention, and one of them happens to know a new mission president who was called last year and reached out to him. And that mission president said, no, I never received a copy of this book. If this statement is not true, which I'm kind of inclined to believe it's not based on just the interaction that I've had, what is the advantage of being less than truthful about this? And there's this weird kind of thing that seems to be going on with Heartlanders. Is on the one hand, according to Bruce, you were just talking about this, that according to this, that Jonathan Neville believes that the First Presidency is being led astray by church scholars and historians and so forth. And yet on the other hand, they're saying that, hey, the First Presidency is sending copies of our book to everybody. Well, are we supposed to find that faith-promoting or not? If the First Presidency is really out to lunch, as Jonathan Neville seems to be indicating, then sending copies of the Heartlander Book of Mormon may be indication that they are out. I don't know. It's a very confusing. It's like playing chess against somebody who can only think one step ahead, and that's it. you know, and meanwhile, everyone else is, you know, five steps ahead trying to figure out some kind of goal. It's like, do you think about the end results of making claims like this? Do you, I don't know. It's just, it's very weird.
Well, it is. And you know, I have a volume that Farms put out probably 20, 25 years ago. That's a collection of various Book of Mormon geographies, all the way back to the earliest ones. And it's, you know, it's actually a very nice collection. I'd love to see it updated and republished, because you can sort of trace the history of different theories of the Book of Mormon and different approaches and so on and so forth. And there are, I'm pretty sure there's some Heartland-like models in it, basically North American-centered ones, though the two predominant ones have typically been hemispheric and Mesoamerican. There are a few other ones, Baja California. There's ones that say was South America, but most of South America was underwater until Christ's crucifixion. That's
a weird one.
That's a weird one. And there's zero. There's all geological, geographic, biological, and cultural evidence.
Anthropological.
There's
evidence for thousands of years going back of people living in the Amazon Basin. I mean, come on, really?
But you know, I have, they're more than welcome to make their arguments, but they have to be intellectually honest in making their arguments, and this isn't a matter of faith. The church has made it clear time and again. This is, you know, the message of the Book of Mormon is what we've been talking about the previous hour. It's repent or be destroyed. It's not, you know, whether, you know, just exactly what river basin Zarahemla was located in.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and I am baffled by this, and I am very uncomfortable because, unlike, frankly, most Book of Mormon scholars, the Heartland Group seems to be a for-profit organization. They have lots and lots of DVDs and books and pamphlets and everything else that they sell to their heart's content. It's not something that's being sold by a third-party publisher. It's something that, you know, you can go on and sell, and then you have stuff that's going to the extent of, you know, how the Nephite remnant ended up in Britain. Which is an actual video production that the Heartland people put into. So, anyway, Chris.
Well, I'm sitting here completely off the page, but I'm imagining St. Peter at the pearly gates, and as you approach, he's going to say, okay, here's the question that determines whether you end up in the celestial, terrestrial, and telestial kingdom. Was the Book of Mormon, the geography of the Book of Mormon, did it take place in North America, South America, or Central America? This is not the intention of the Book of Mormon. If it was the intention, it certainly would have been more clearly articulated. And that's not where the brethren want us to focus our attention. Now, you know, if people are interested, and they want to do some research or investigation, and, you know, and we do look for proof of things. And so I can see that being done. But when you get off on tangents, and a tangent, I just looked it up, is something, a completely different line of thought or action. When you get off on these kind of tangents and you're devoting so much time and effort, where I would argue that perhaps it would be better if you were spending your time becoming more conversant with the doctrine of the gospel of Jesus Christ, or just going out and serving other people as Jesus Christ did, you'd be far better off than spending enormous amounts of time. And then once you take a position, when you double down on it and defend it at all costs, that's, you know, a very treacherous position to put yourself in as well. And so, you know, one of the things, too, is that when someone says something and it's very difficult to promote or perpetuate a mistruth. And so once you say something, and then you kind of, oftentimes you'll start to embellish, or you'll have to remember what you said that was untrue the last time. It's difficult. It's just difficult to perpetuate these kinds of things. To me, I've never really been particularly interested where it took place. for me, it's the doctrinal content that's the heart of the Book of Mormon, and that's where I try to spend much of my time. But again, evidentiary things are important, if that's somebody's kind of thing. But I would be really careful about, you know, getting so locked into one point of view that then you become contentious. Because that, of course, is then, you know, making room for Satan and his minions.
Can I follow up on on this? I agree with what Chris said, and what's weird about this, and it supports what you mentioned a minute ago, Bruce, is that the primary message of the Book of Mormon is repentance and following the commandments of God, and don't get sucked into secret combinations and so forth, all the things that we were talking about back in the first hour. And I'm sure that our brothers and sisters who are followers of the Heartland, whatever you want to call it, the belief or system or theory, would agree with us. But it seems that there's a lot of emphasis within that movement toward the most important message of the Book of Mormon is really that the United States is God's promised land, and that if you don't believe that the Book of Mormon took place inside the United States, then you disbelieve in the promises that God has made to the United States and so forth. And you know, clearly from the Doctrine and Covenants, you know, the Constitution was inspired by God and of the principles that are in there. But I think there's kind of a nationalistic sort of thing that's going on with Heartlanders. It's, you know, it's you know, America, rah rah, and aren't we amazing? And everyone else is, you know, needs to be like us. And it just kind of really bothers me, especially in a day and age where most Latter-day Saints don't live in the United States anymore.
And to your point, let me make something clear. I mean, started subscribing to Farm's review of books. Actually, it was originally called Books on the Book of Mormon. I forget, I've got all my back issues and so on. I've followed Book of Mormon scholarship closely for 20 to 30 years. And when you read most reputable Book of Mormon scholarship, there is no political agenda. The approach is, okay, here's this the interesting thing in the Book of Mormon. I can tie this into, you know, ancient Near Eastern stuff. My Book of Mormon study, I've literally been reading Brant Gardner's 6-volume commentary, cover to cover. I'm almost done. And he's pitching it in a Mesoamerican. He's very honest about, you know, here's something we don't understand, or, you know, this doesn't seem to jibe. But he's also very clear about his faithful belief in the Book of Mormon as a real ancient document and so on and so forth. But, you know, when you see, I see disagreements between, say, Brant Gardner and John Sorensen and Royal Skousen about translation and about certain things. But it's never a political argument. It is a logical, academic discussion. Here's how I interpret this. This is how I interpret this aspect and so on. And to your point, Mike, the Heartland stuff is shot through and through with political arguments, and there seems to be a very close tie based on the sessions they've had at their so-called Firm Foundation conferences, a very close tie with young earth creationism, you know, promoting a science theory that says the center of the earth is ice. I mean, it's scary. It's not scholarship. Whatever it is, it's not scholarship. It is, they start with the assumption that Cumorah was the Cumorah of the Book of Mormon, and that Zarahemla, the city that Joseph Smith named Zarahemla across the river from Nauvoo, was the actual city of Zarahemla. And that's their foundation for everything else. And they disagree. I've seen Jonathan Neville come back and try and disagree or dispute this, but I have seen his printed statement that, frankly, the fourth item is whether or not what the Book of Mormon says. That's last on our list of interpretations. Okay, so that was an interesting 2 hours. Went by fast. Thanks for joining us. We'll be here next week for the next group. This is the Interpreter Foundation Radio Show, and you have a good week.